Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 1400 hours GMT on Thursday, the 24th of October, these are our main stories. British police believe the 39 people found dead in the back of a lorry in England were Chinese nationals. Spain moves the remains of the dictator Francisco Franco from a national monument to a modest grave. A Bangladesh court hands out death sentences to the killers of a young girl who was burned to death after she said she was sexually harassed. Also in this podcast, they've had hits around the world, but Coldplay released their new music in a local newspaper. We begin this podcast with the latest on the truck container found in Britain, which contained the bodies of 39 people. Police now say they believe the people who died were Chinese nationals. It's not yet clear when and where they entered the refrigerated trailer. Police in Northern Ireland have searched two properties said to be linked to the deaths. According to the authorities in Bulgaria, the truck is registered there to an Irish company. Ahmed al-Rashid is a Syrian refugee whose journey from Aleppo to Hull in northeast England took 55 days, during which time he hid himself in a series of trucks, including a refrigerated container.
The first time it was not a lorry. It was a lorry, but it was a kind of a container. So it was a kind of a freezer fridge. At that time, I just was so desperate. I just wanted to do it because the smuggler at that time told me, yeah, it's going to be 2 hours. You don't have to worry about it. It's going to be so easy. So we agreed. We went into the container and he locked the door. And inside there was light, but it was freezing cold. And almost after 2 hours, we all started, you know, really having a very hard time trying to breathe. But eventually we realized that this lorry is not moving, this container is not moving. So we started to knock and knock and knock and knock. Then eventually the driver came and he let us out. I was already separated from my family. So my wife and little child at that time were in eastern Aleppo under bombardment and shelling. I could not get them out. So the only thing that kept me moving and motivated and hopeful that I will make it and safely, then I'll be able to get them out of that hell in eastern Syria.
Well, Ahmed went on to describe his feelings when he heard the news of these latest deaths.
You're talking about 39 human beings. How many times they shouted and screamed for help, but no one was there. Traffickers and human smugglers who do not see you as a human being, they see you as a commodity, as a number, as money. But also anger, because many of these, you know, crossing and stuff would have been avoided if many of these peoples were be given legal pathways to make these journeys instead of this money going to the smugglers and human traffickers.
That was Ahmed al-Rashid, a Syrian refugee. Well, for more on what the police are saying about the 39 people found dead, I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
They've now released more information about the sexes of the people who are found. They are 8 women, one of whom is supposed to be a young adult. Yesterday they were talking about a teenager. They are basically trying to deal with this situation with as much dignity and compassion for the victims as they possibly can. Forensic people are with them, and they're also, all these victims are going to have to go for a coroner to try to establish the cause of death, which is not yet clear. Obviously, it was a refrigerated container, but it's not clear whether they perhaps suffocated or whether it was something to do with the cold. So there's still lots to be answered there. The Belgian police are trying to find out things their end. They're investigating to see who might have been behind it. And there is a suspect in custody at the moment in Britain. He's not been charged with anything. He's being held on suspicion of murder. And the Essex police say that 3 properties in the County Armagh in Northern Ireland have been searched.
And what kind of possibilities will the police be looking at in terms of the organisation of this, whether or not it's human trafficking or some kind of migrant route into Britain?
Well, they're the migrant routes are well established, both from places like Calais and ports in Belgium, for example, say Brugge, where this container was shipped from. Police in Belgium say lots of people every night are trying to get on lorries, and they're in different lorry parks, not just close to the actual ferry port themselves. So whether it's people smuggling, so something to do with consent, or whether it's something to do with people trafficking, which is a different issue, is not yet been established. That's one of the lines of inquiry.
Danny Eberhard. And as Danny was saying there, we still don't know why those 39 people were in the container. But there are similarities to a case in 2000 when 58 Chinese people died in an airtight container on the back of a truck that came into the British port of Dover. Jack Straw was Home Secretary at the time, and he spoke to Sarah Montague about that day.
Well, I remember it very clearly because this happened later on Sunday, the 18th of June, and I was phoned in the small hours to tell me about it. And the next day I made as detailed a statement as I could to the House of Commons about it. And as you say, it's many similarities. Sadly, there were even more casualties on the occasion in the year 2000, 58, and 54 were men. Four women. Miraculously, there were two survivors as well. But one of the differences is that I'd been arguing both internally in Parliament and with fellow interior ministers, indeed with fellow interior ministers just the weekend before, that we had to step up security measures against people trafficking. I'd got through measures in what was the 1999 Immigration and Asylum Act to penalise carriers who had any illegals on. There was a strict liability offence, regardless of whether there was any evidence that they knew about it. And we were improving measures to detect in British ports as well as abroad. But things have moved on very significantly since then in terms of technology and cooperation. So I'm surprised this has happened, but it's very difficult completely to eliminate.
One of the things we've been hearing about this case is the challenge, not least, in identifying who these people were. Now, obviously, there were two survivors in this case, but was it a challenge then?
It was a huge challenge because one of the things the traffickers had done was to require all the migrants to remove every possible item of identification. Obviously, all their papers were removed, but labels on their clothing, things like that, which would have led to some identification. And extraordinarily, the police who were investigating this spotted that there was a leather belt, which was made of two layers of leather, and the stitching looked uneven. And when they examined this further, they discovered that sewing into the stitching was the identification details of one of the poor souls who died. And that gave the police a good lead on who the gangs were. And in the end, it turned out that it was a snakehead gang in China.
Right, because there were well-worn routes, effectively, for groups of Chinese migrants to come. To go all over the world, presumably.
But it was an extremely difficult investigation. These people, traffickers, are completely and utterly ruthless. So they treat the migrants, worse than they would treat cattle.
That was the former British Home Secretary, Jack Straw. The coveted Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought has been awarded to the jailed Uyghur human rights defender Ilham Tohti. The European Parliament said the Uyghur people had been subjected to unparalleled repression by the Chinese government. From Brussels, here's Kevin Connolly.
The European Parliament's Sakharov Prize was created to honour defenders of human rights and freedom of thought. Ilham Tohti is a university lecturer and blogger who has tried to defend the rights of the Uyghur minority in China. He was jailed for life 5 years ago on a charge of separatism, that is, supporting regional autonomy for the Uyghur people. His trial was widely criticised in the West. He was denied access to his lawyers, who said they were not allowed to see the Chinese state's alleged evidence against him.
Kevin Connolly. Now on to a question of transport and the impact aeroplanes are having on the environment. Campaigners like Greta Thunberg say we should think about whether planes are viable transport options at all. She sailed to the US to speak at the UN in New York. But for many people, air travel is not just a luxury, but a necessary part of conducting business, and has been for a while.
London's Heathrow Airport took the arrival of the world's first fully loaded jumbo jet with surprising ease. But the huge airliner attracted a large number of pressmen and had members of the public thronging the vantage points to get a better look at the aircraft which will revolutionise the future of civil aviation. They've never seen anything like it before, but they'll be seeing a lot more in the years ahead.
Can't you just visualise the trilbies and the top hats there from the Pathé News clip? Well, an old clip maybe from London Heathrow Airport. And commercial flights aside, the flight stars of the rich and famous often come in for bigger scrutiny. Remember the scandal over Britain's Prince Harry and wife Meghan taking private jets recently? Well, over in Las Vegas, the world's biggest industry show for those kind of private jets is coming to a close. And a key theme this year were models that were described as more environmentally friendly than normal planes. So how can aviation as an industry ever be green? My colleague Dan Damon put that question to Dr. Rick Hufnagels from the University of Utrecht and the Copernicus Institute of Sustainable Development.
The aviation sector is not that large when it comes to climate contribution today. Relatively, it's only 2.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but the sector is growing very fast. It doubled between the year 2000 and 2015, and that growth is only continuing in the future. By 2030, it's expected that its share will be 3.5%. So we need, that growth needs to stop. That's the first thing. So we need to reduce the growth, especially in the energy requirement and the fuel requirement of aviation. And secondly, we need also to green the fuel that is required by aviation.
And that means biofuels. Where does biofuel, aviation fuel, come from?
Biomass, that's a very broad definition. It includes all organic material, actually. But it's now produced from used cooking oil, so fats and oils, as well as from vegetable oils.
And is that cheaper than kerosene?
No, it's roughly, I think, still twice as expensive compared to fossil kerosene. So it's the cheapest renewable option available on the market, but it's still roughly twice as expensive compared to fossil kerosene.
So it doesn't sound all that hopeful then as a policy for reducing the contribution to greenhouse gases from aviation.
Well, if we would start to blend biofuels in aviation today, just to get experience with the product itself, to get sustainable supply chains on the market, that includes also sustainability certification, for example, we need that experience and we need those volumes. If we would include, for example, a share of roughly 10 to 15% on it would increase the price of European flights with only a few euros, so 5 euros at most, and intercontinental flights maybe 20 to 30 euros. So it's not dramatically expensive if you look at it from that perspective. So that would increase the increase on the ticket price.
And that would provide investment for developing the biofuel technology. Is that the hope?
Indeed, we really need experience, especially we don't have that much time anymore to develop these sectors, to develop sustainable supply chains. It's really required time. So we need experience. And this is the period 2020-2030 is really the moment to start developing those supply chains in a sustainable way.
That was Dr. Rick Hufnagels, and he was speaking to Dan Damon. Now, to a group that's taking promoting new music right back to basics. That is, of course, Coldplay, one of the world's biggest bands, and it seems when you've sold over 75 million albums, then you don't feel the need to make a big advertising splash to get people interested in your next release. In fact, you go way smaller. BBC's Newsbeat entertainment reporter Steve Holden told me about the band's alternate plan.
They put the track listing for their new album in the classified section of the North Wales Daily Post. So literally some good old-fashioned PR.
And you'd normally be finding things like adverts for yoga classes and the
it
like.
It was opposite an advert for a fridge freezer and a divan bed. But somebody picked up on it. Apparently the editor didn't even know that this had gone in. But it's because Johnny in the band used to work at this newspaper back in the day. But this is the latest in a couple of things they've done. They sent a letter to a fan announcing their new album. She thought it was a hoax. And then someone spotted in Madrid a poster, a 1920 style poster of the band above a theatre. Is that Coldplay? Are we sure that's Coldplay? Yes, it was Coldplay. And sure enough, the album's coming out soon.
And these kind of under-the-radar bits of marketing and advertising that go decidedly above the radar are pretty common, aren't they?
They are now. This is good old-fashioned fun from PR companies. I don't think this is about them not having the marketing budgets, because they clearly do. But we look at people like Taylor Swift. We look at people like Ariana Grande. They like to tease their fans. It's all about the big tease. I'm coming back with something. I'm not going to quite tell you what it is yet. Ariana Grande started tweeting in an upside down font to announce her return to music. Arcade Fire announced they did a big graffiti mural in New York. People think, you know what? They are coming back. They don't have to do a big press release anymore. People like the fun and games of it.
Steve Holden. Still to come in this podcast. I just took a DNA test. Turns out I'm 100% dead. When does a catchphrase go from a homage to stolen property? American pop star Lizzo is about to find out. To Spain now, where the coffin of the former Spanish dictator Francisco Franco has been exhumed from the basilica where he'd been buried 44 years ago. General Franco's tomb at the huge state monument, Valley of the Fallen, has long caused resentment from many Spanish people, not just those on the left. Spain's socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez, who ordered his removal, has called it a victory for dignity and justice. However, many of Franco's supporters, who believe he saved Catholic Spain from communism, arrived at the cemetery on Thursday morning to protest the exhumation.
I never thought that we would get to these extremes. Never. These are political quarrels. And I think it's the story of Spain, that you have to respect the dead that have spent 45 years there already. It all seems to me, I don't know, surreal.
General Franco's remains are currently being transported via helicopter to a private cemetery for reburial. Our correspondent Guy Hedgeco told me more. At the time of recording this, he was at the monument near Madrid.
Well, at the moment, we're just waiting for the helicopter carrying General Franco's remains to fly to Mingo Rubio Cemetery. That's the reburial site on the outskirts of Madrid, a low-key cemetery chosen by the Spanish government. And it will land near the cemetery. The remains will be taken inside in the same coffin in which Franco was buried 44 years ago. His family has insisted that he be reburied in the same coffin. And family members of Franco, grandchildren and great-grandchildren, will be there. And a priest will hold a Catholic mass as he is reburied in the cemetery.
Guy, from what we heard in the clip just a moment ago, if the Spanish government's attempt was to sort of draw a line under the divisions of the past, it's not necessarily going to succeed, is it?
Well, it's such a sensitive issue, the issue of historical memory and Franco's legacy. It's so divisive that I think it's going to be difficult to draw a line under it, certainly immediately. Campaigners for historical memory say that there are many other issues that need to be tackled, that this is just the tip of the iceberg in a way, because, for example, there are over 100,000 unmarked graves of victims of Franco still lying around the country. Campaigners say that those need to be identified and exhumed. For certain people on the right, it's always going to be, they're always going to resist it. They don't feel this is the right way to go, and they feel that simply these issues from the past should be left in the past.
That was Guy Hedgeco. A court in Bangladesh has sentenced 14 men and two women to death, including two politicians from the ruling Awami League party. That's for the murder of a female student. Nusrat Jahan Rafi was 19 when she died in April after being set alight by a mob on the roof of her religious school in eastern Bangladesh, succumbing to her burns 4 days later. She had refused to withdraw an allegation of sexual harassment against the principal of the school. Akbar Hussain is from the BBC's Bengali service. He spoke to Nusrat's brother, Feni, in Bangladesh and told Dan Damon what he said.
Nusrat's brother basically saying that he was giving thanks to all people who were actually demanding justice. He actually thanked media, police and other investigating agencies that they performed the investigation in a quick time. That is exactly what he is saying. And he has also said that they were happy with the justice and they thought they got justice.
And he's thanking the court for moving swiftly, because normally murder trials take a very long time, and especially when politicians who are linked to the ruling party are involved. So this has been justice in a way that will please an awful lot of people.
Yes, it is, because this is one of the quickest verdicts delivered in Bangladesh's judicial history. And in Bangladesh, you know, sexual harassment in educational institutions like schools, colleges, universities and madrasas, this is widespread. But generally, women, they don't come forward and they don't take the courage of filing cases against the perpetrators. But those who actually speaks loud, the cost is very high. And Nusrat is one of the examples that who actually spoke very tough against the head teacher, and she filed a case. That's why she was set on fire, and she had to die. In Bangladesh, whenever any politicians, basically people from ruling party, are involved with any criminal activity, it is very difficult for the victims to get justice. But this Nusrat case incident is different, because many people, they demanded justice immediately after the killing in the social media, which actually forced the government and police department to reinvestigate the whole murder case and moving it to forward very quickly.
Akbar Hussain. The chief executive of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, has faced hostile questioning in Congress about his plans to launch a new cryptocurrency known as Libra. Senators and congressmen and women argue the payment system could be abused by criminals and terrorists, and also accused Mr. Zuckerberg of lying to US regulators in the past. Our North America technology reporter Dave Lee sent this report from Washington.
Mark Zuckerberg knows his company's reputation is at rock bottom, so he used this hearing to reiterate a position that he knows plays well here. If Facebook is held back from creating this new global currency, Mr. Zuckerberg said, China would do it instead.
While we debate these issues, the rest of the world isn't waiting. China is moving quickly to launch a similar idea in the coming months. Libra is going to be backed mostly by dollars, and I believe that it will extend America's financial leadership around the world, as well as our democratic values and oversight. But if America doesn't innovate, our financial leadership is not guaranteed.
Mr. Zuckerberg said he would seek approval from all the relevant US regulators before going ahead with the Libra project anywhere in the world. As is often the case when any tech giant visits Washington, any issue is on the table. There were sharp criticisms of Facebook's decision to not fact-check political advertising, and concern that the company's plan to introduce added security could provide a safe haven for paedophilia. Last year, more than 15 million images of child sexual abuse were shared on Facebook.
Dave Lee. Now to the world of music, and a simple one-liner that's causing a huge headache for the American singer-songwriter Lizzo, one of the biggest breakout stars of 2019. Her most famous song, Truth Hurts, stormed the charts, debuting at number one in the US and staying there for a record amount of time. But one of its now world-famous opening lines is causing chaos. As someone else says, they brainstormed that phrase. Charlotte Gallagher explains.
Why are men great till they gotta be great?
Truth Hurts has been embraced as an anthem of self-love and empowerment. At Lizzo concerts, her fans chant the lyrics back at her. And this lyric in particular has sparked countless memes and even T-shirt slogans.
I just took a DNA test, turns out I'm 100% dead.
If you know Lizzo, you'll know that one word is missing from the lyric. What can I say? It's the BBC. But for the last few weeks, Lizzo has been battling allegations that she failed to give credit to two songwriters. Justin and Jeremiah Raisin say the line, "I just took a DNA test, turns out I'm 100% that came from a writing session they were part of." Now Lizzo has hit back on Twitter, denying their allegations, saying the song is her life and her truth. But she also acknowledged that the signature lyric was inspired by a tweet by a British singer called Mina Lioness, saying that she'll be added to the songwriting credits. Lizzo's lawyer has also announced that she's filed a lawsuit against the Raisins. Lizzo is reportedly trying to trademark the infamous lyric to use on merchandise, meaning anyone associated with owning the lyric could be in for a pretty good payday.
Charlotte Gallagher reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.